Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. You can listen to all our episodes on Podbean, Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. Enjoy. For many people who live and work in London, an Extinction Rebellion protest has become a staple event of the calendar. This year is no exception. Thousands of exiled protesters have descended into the capital, aiming to shut down 8 sites in the city and to squeeze a new commitment to cease public investment in fossil fuels out of Boris Johnson. An animal welfare march will take place at Smithfield's meat market, and play-ins for Extinction Rebellion members and their young families are expected to occupy a major bank in the city. It's estimated that since 2019, Extinction Rebellion protests have cost the taxpayer more than £50 million. The protests are often disruptive, include mindless vandalism, and take up a lot of police time and money. For the rest of the country, Extinction Rebellion is an enigma, a movement that only holds sway in trendy cities of London, Bristol, and Brighton. But if we isolate Extinction Rebellion's main aim of making politicians and industry adopt climate-friendly policies, the majority of the nation is broadly on board. According to YouGov polling, 68% of Brits believe concerns around climate change have not been exaggerated, and the threat is every bit as real as climate scientists have said. Surveys also suggest 54% of people in the UK see climate change as the biggest threat to humanity above COVID. Although most of us support the primary aim of Extinction Rebellion, most of us would fervently disassociate ourselves with the movement. Are Extinction Rebellion a force for good in the battle to address climate change, or are they doing more harm than good? With me to discuss this today are two of my colleagues from the Institute of Economic Affairs, Head of Political Economy Dr. Christian Nemet and Head of Media Emily Carver. Welcome both. Emily, if I may start with you, I think it's safe to say that we all see climate change as a problem for humanity. But what is it about Extinction Rebellion which makes people so anti-Extinction Rebellion, in your opinion?
Well, there are many reasons, of course. I think firstly, we all do, yes, see climate change as an issue. I mean, the public always say in polling, in recent polling, that this is one of their priorities for policymakers. But I think one of the reasons why people get fed up with Extinction Rebellion is because they don't see it in the same catastrophic terms as Extinction Rebellion like to push. So that would be one reason why people are fed up with them. They seem to be largely, at least the leadership, seem to be largely a bit of a doomsday cult. They talk about the annihilation of the planet if we don't get our carbon emissions down to net zero across the board, across the world. They talk about millions of people dying if we don't do X, Y, and Z. Some of their demands are, well, completely unrealistic and would mean that we'd essentially be living in some kind of, I don't know, in a drastically different way. Our quality of life would be diminished if we were to reach one of their recommendations, which is net zero by 2025, which is in 4 years' time. So that would be catastrophic for our quality of life. I think also what people get annoyed by, and it's something that I get annoyed by, is the makeup of the people protesting and the way that they protest. It seems to a lot of people that they seem to be sort of middle-class hippie types who have the spare time to be able to, blockade roads in the middle of the day. A lot of student types who seem to be there just to have a good time, sort of festival vibes. I mean, walking through last summer, you had people just sort of dancing in the streets, taking drugs. I don't know how good they are for the environment. So there's the hypocrisy element that I think we're going to come on to later. And I think they also talk about how this is all about climate change and saving the environment. But when you dig a little deeper and you just look at their website, it's all about system change. And I think that's something that Christian will probably come on to. It's not just climate change. In order to enact it, it's pretty obvious that they want to completely transform, rip down whatever sort of capitalist structure we currently have and replace it with something that we don't know what it is. So those are a few reasons.
Brilliant. Yeah. But I mean, one thing that really annoys people on climate change is when, leaders or spokespeople preach the need for everyone to go green and buy expensive and often inefficient green technology to reduce their carbon footprint. And then it turns out they themselves are still using the technology they wish to eradicate. You know, embarrassingly, this happened to a founding member of Extinction Rebellion, Dr. Gail Bradbrook. who admitted she still drives a diesel car. So a question for both of you. Do you think movements like this often demand too much from people? I mean, Emily, you've touched on that. And are they therefore prone to hypocrisy?
Yeah, it feels a bit strange for me to defend Extinction Rebellion, but I think in this case I have to. Because if this is a genuine collective action problem, and climate change is a collective action problem, then you can't expect individuals to make changes unilaterally. That's the thing with collective action problems. We may collectively agree that we would all be better off if we reduced carbon emissions, or if we did something else, some collective course of action. But if you as an individual just unilaterally lower your emissions without having a good reason to expect that lots of other people will follow and do the same, then you're not making any impact. It's not as if any individual had a noticeable impact on the global climate. For local externalities, it's a bit different, but clearly for a global externality, no single individual has an impact on the climate. So this is a situation where it is quite rational to say, yes, I am in favor of a particular course of action, but not on my own, only when lots of other people do it too. And this is true in general where you have collective action problems. We've seen this with COVID. We've seen that most people are prepared to accept certain restrictions on their behavior, whether that be a full lockdown or milder measures like mask wearing. But most people would not be prepared to do that if they had the impression that they're the only ones sitting at home while everyone else is going out and having a great time. Of course, then you wouldn't do it. So there it's quite rational to say, no, I'm not doing anything unless other people do it too.
I'm not sure I buy that. I think it's passing the buck. I mean, I see that argument for sure. But if you're not willing to even make small changes in your life, then how on earth can you expect other people to do so? Because they do talk, of course, they talk about that we need government and international action in order to make these changes. I mean, it's mostly based on prohibitions and restrictions on the way people live their lives. But they do also talk about the little changes you can make, the things that you can make on a daily basis. And if this Extinction Rebellion person, this co-leader, can't even change the way that she drives around, then how can she expect other people to fit the bill for more dramatic changes that other people can do? But I think it's a way of sort of getting away from that argument by just saying, well, it's all about system change, therefore we can't enact anything ourselves, so it's not our fault if we're hypocrites. There was a GB News interview with another chap who was very smartly dressed in a suit. He was I think he ran a recruitment agency or company or whatever in the city. And he was an Extinction Rebellion spokesperson, not the sort of typical. But he said, we are all hypocrites, when he was, you know, pressed on the fact that he perhaps hadn't made any changes to his lifestyle. And, you know, I think that's doesn't really, I think that jars with a lot of people.
Yeah.
Okay. There is also the point that it's one thing if, as a given, a random individual, you say, okay, I have zero impact on the global climate. It's rational for me to carry on as I do. But if you are the leader of a high profile member of an organization like that, then it's a bit different, because then there is some chance that people will copy your behavior, that you will be to some extent a role model. And there the collective action argument is a bit different, because there you do have a reason to expect that at least some people are going to follow you. And there's also the wider issue that historically, at least, Extinction Rebellion may be a bit different, but historically, at least, environmentalism has always been strongly linked to anti-consumerism. It's been inseparable from it. And so what I mean by that is that environmentalists never just said, we should reduce certain types of consumption for the sake of the planet, but we should do that reluctantly. That's a price we have to pay. The general message has always been, we consume too much anyway, and material consumption is soulless, and it's not making us happy anyway. We should be adopting more simple lives. So it's always been the reduction in consumption has been presented as a virtue in its own right, rather than just a necessary price to pay. And if that is your attitude, if you think people should adopt minimalistic lifestyles for aesthetic reasons, then in that regard, there is no collective action problem whatsoever. That you can absolutely do on your own, mm-hmm. voluntarily. You don't need anyone else to follow you. And that's always been my issue with anti-consumerists. That anti-consumerists, I have yet to meet an anti-consumerist who leads a minimalistic, ascetic lifestyle themselves. These are usually quite affluent people who enjoy their affluence, and good on them, but who want everyone else to lead miserable lives.
It's quite interesting, the minimalism movement. There's a lot of young people, particularly sort of under the age of, I don't know, 25, who are doing this minimalism, cutting down drastically what they own, you know, chucking out all their clothes or passing them on and so on. But I think it is mostly for show, because then you find out a little later that they're going on holiday and they're going by a plane. So that probably counters that, but it's quite interesting psychologically.
So our head of cultural affairs, Mark Glendening, came out quite strongly this week, and he said, and I quote, XR, like other constituent parts of the new ultra-left coalition, celebrate an anti-Western and anti-rationalist agenda based upon closing down the productive economy and the free expression of a plurality of viewpoints. Now, some listening to this would argue that's quite an extreme position. What do you think about that, Christian? Is Extinction Rebellion fundamentally anti-liberal because they seek to impose a lifestyle or a worldview on people?
Yes, I think that's absolutely a fair assessment. I don't think Mark Glendening is being unfair on them here. And that's not that surprising if you bear in mind how these groups see themselves. They believe that it is their mission to save humanity from literal extinction. I mean, clue is in the name. So if that is your self-perception, if that's your image of yourself, of course, then you're not going to value pluralism and debate and disagreement very much in its own right. If you think that you have the agenda that's required to save the planet, save humanity from extinction, then, of course, you're not going to be thrilled by other people having other points of views. And in such a situation, you cannot be in a mood to say, oh, well, okay, let's agree to disagree. Okay, you want to burn down the planet, I want to save humanity, but we can still get along and we can still have a pint together. That's just not how this works. That's the attitude you can have if you disagree with someone on fiscal policy, let's say. But not if you think that your ideas would cause death and destruction, my ideas are salvation, then of course you can't be relaxed and say, okay, we may disagree on this, but whatever. So therefore it's clear where this mindset comes from. But more specifically, the reason why I think environmentalism has always been an anti-rationalist and quite a primitive movement, is that environmentalists tend to be bizarrely opposed to technology-led, low-cost, cost-effective solutions, such as, for example, fracking, use of shale gas, or nuclear energy. If this is really all about carbon emissions for you, then logically you should be massively in favor of low-cost sources of carbon. Of course, you can still acknowledge risks of fracking, risks of nuclear energy, but if you think that the planet is going to burn, you should see that as absolutely trivial in comparison, that risk, and you should be massively in favor of that. But it just, for the typical environmentalist, those technologies just don't feel right and they are viscerally opposed. And also, if we solve the problem in that way through technologies, it wouldn't have this religious element of self-flagellation and repentance, and that's why it's unattractive to them. But that's just not just Extinction Rebellion. That's always been the case with groups like Greenpeace. Their opposition to genetically modified food, for example, completely irrational from an environmental perspective, because of course, if you can genetically modify food in such a way that it's more resistant to the weather or to all kinds of hazards, and more productive in that way, then that means you can shrink the surface area that we use for agriculture, and it means that you have more space for nature. So you should be massively in favor of that. But if you think people are the problem, if you think we are the baddies in the story and we need to save the planet from ourselves, then that, things like that are not going to appeal to you.
And on that religious fervor point, I mean, I think it's there have been people who have left the group, and it does feel like when they talk, it was like leaving a cult, like leaving a religious sect. There's that woman who was, what's her name, Zion, or who came out as being pro-nuclear, and she got a lot of abuse from Extinction Rebellion, I believe, for that, but completely changed her mind on the aims and the way that we are going to, well, combat climate change. So it's quite interesting in that respect.
Yeah, there's lots of stories like that. Not long before Extinction Rebellion existed, people who left Greenpeace and then sometimes go on to become, I wouldn't say anti-environmentalist, but a completely different type of environmentalist, much closer to the type of free market environmentalism that we might embrace. Mm. And they often start disagreeing with the group on one particular issue, but then they get ostracized for that and become more hostile. And this really is the dynamic of a cult. This is something that we wouldn't have here. Let's say we may disagree on one or two topics, but that doesn't mean that you would then become a communist just to make a point or to wind up your former allies. It wouldn't work that way. We would say, okay, I think you're wrong on this, but so what?
Yeah.
And but it is this cult-like behavior that you get in these groups that it may start with just one minor issue, but then you are already a traitor, and you must be in the pay of some industry or whatever, and it then leads to this kind of behavior.
I wonder if we've ever had a former IEA colleague come out as a commie after leaving here. Be quite
well, I've heard
make
of it
a great
happen.
Article.
I've heard of it happen the other way around, but like,
well, that's what we want.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Well, we would have heard of such a person. they would have a column in the Guardian, the Independent. They would be on Novara Media for them.
So critics often class Extinction Rebellion as a left-wing organisation, but they themselves claim not to be. So last year they tweeted, "We are not a socialist movement." Quite clearly, are we in danger of strawmanning them? You know, are we pigeonholing them into categories which we are comfortable with to deal with? Christian and Emily, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think as with many other protest movements, you know, like BLM and others, the leaders, I think, and Christian can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's the leadership who seem to be having this hard left ideology. They want to see system change, whatever that means. And they don't always know what they want to replace it, but they know that capitalism is the enemy. But to be fair to the members of Extinction Rebellion and to the people out on the protests, I think a lot of them are there for what they see as a positive movement. They're there because they care about the environment. They probably aren't thinking every day about, you know, system change or dramatic changes that perhaps the leadership want to enact. So there may be a little difference there between the leadership and the membership. However, when you do walk through an Extinction Rebellion protest, you do see it is coupled often with socialist workers' banners. It's coupled with the hammer and sickle on occasion, like with the Black Lives Matter protests. And there seems to be a lot of it mixed in with the other.
Yeah, but I don't think we should let the rank and file members off the hook here. It's not just a corrupt leadership, but a noble and pure good guys on the streets. We have to look at the context of this. It's true that they once said, we are not a socialist organization. But that was in response to, there was an Extinction Rebellion protest in London, and one group within that protest march held up a hammer and sickle sign and with the slogan socialism or barbarism. And in response to that, Extinction Rebellion then tweeted, this doesn't represent us, we are not a socialist organization. Okay, so far so good. What happened then, that's the more interesting bit. Firstly, they got piled on by hundreds, if not thousands, of their own sympathizers or members, and that shows it is very much the rank and file member. They got mad at them.
They might be even worse. Yes,
they might well be worse. They got mad at them for saying we're not a socialist organization, and then Extinction Rebellion, whoever runs their Twitter account, came back to clarify this and said, just to be clear here, when we say we are not a socialist organization, we don't mean that we are anti-socialist. We just mean that in the sense of we are not exclusively a socialist organization, but we are anti-capitalist. That's what they said. I paraphrase, not a literal quote, but I mean, if you look up Extinction Rebellion capitalism or Extinction Rebellion socialism, something like that, that is what they said. Now that narrows it down a bit. Okay, if you're anti-capitalist but not a socialist, then what are you? When they say we are not a socialist organization, they don't mean this in the sense that they would be open to a market-based solution to environmental problems. They don't mean this in the sense that that they would be open to, let's say, a libertarian technology optimist who believes that geoengineering is the way to deal with these problems. Such a person would absolutely not be welcome in Extinction Rebellion. When they say they are anti-capitalist, they are making clear that when they say we're not socialists, it's not that they mean this in the sense of we have some time for free marketeers. That's clearly not what they mean by that. It's not that a liberal environmentalist or a conservative environmentalist would be welcome. I think what they mean is simply there are people who are in favor of what they call a degrowth economy or a steady state economy. These are all ideas for economies that are where everything or production is small scale and local. So a bit like the Shire in Lord of the Rings with solar panels. So some romanticized idea of the Middle Ages with some renewable energy thrown in. Such an economy is not capitalist, but it's not socialist either in the conventional sense. It's nothing. It would be nothing like the Soviet Union. So in that sense, they may be right when they say they're not a socialist organization, but they don't mean this in the sense of we are a broad church. People who are in favor of a steady state economy or of a degrowth economy are also far left. So therefore, it's absolutely fair to describe them as far left, if not technically just socialist. I would say they are a far left organization, which is, if not in itself socialist, then at least an organization that, well, socialists are more than welcome, and where in practice most people are socialists.
I think they're a very confused movement. I know you see all the different the local groups. And the stuff that they tweet is particularly extreme. And then they have to be sort of, the leadership has to say, oh no, we didn't mean that, as Christian said. They have to sort of protect their smaller groups.
But then they have to backpedal as well when they get attacked. So
damage limitation. So if we believe that Extinction Rebellion, you know, is left-wing in its philosophy, should we, like organizations like the IEA and others, not be making the case that capitalism can work to save the environment? So recently for the IEA blog, Dr. Rena Zittelmann suggested that consensus arguments that economic growth coincides with environmental degradation and resource consumption is much more nuanced. So he argued the correlation between economic growth and increasing resource consumption is becoming ever weaker in the age of dematerialization. Can you explain a bit more about that, Christian?
Yes. Well, he points out that historically it's been true that a growing economy was linked to greater use of resources, of materials, because a growing economy means people can afford more stuff, and stuff has to be made of something. So therefore, developed economies consumed far more materials than poorer economies. But he says that at some point that correlation disappeared. And the example that he uses is the modern smartphone, which is a good example of that. If you think about, if you had to replace a smartphone with technologies of 1990, what would you do? You would need a computer, first of all, one of those bulky 1990 computers. You would need a telephone. You would need a CD player and lots of CDs. You would need a pocket calculator and whatever else is contained in a smartphone. You would just need a lot more physical stuff, a lot more material. And in that way, nowadays we have all that with a fraction of the materials, and far more. And that is what economic growth in advanced economies means today. It doesn't mean that computers get bigger and bigger. It means, if anything, the opposite. It means that they get more productive. And one way in which that expresses itself is that things get smaller and use less material. Yeah. So this idea that environmentalists have always had, you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. Well, yes, you very much can. Mm. If economic growth means above all becoming more productive and making better use of material that we have rather than just using more and more, then you very much can have infinite growth on a finite planet.
But what about, I don't know, fast fashion? People are consuming far more clothing and footwear and handbags and all these sort of products, and mostly they're made abroad. So surely there's no dematerialization in that case. Surely we're consuming more and more and more, and therefore the production is going increasing.
Yeah, okay. It doesn't work in every single sector. It's just a general tendency that use of material resource, of absolute quantities of materials, is no longer linked to GDP in the way it would have been for previous generations. There are sectors where that may not be the case. But even there, in the case of clothing and fashion, okay, that's an industry that I don't know a great deal about, but, as you can probably quite easily tell.
Our listeners won't be able to see, don't worry.
He's looking lovely.
Well, debatable. There are these indicators that look at CO2 per capita on the basis of not production, but consumption. And the reason why they do that is that there is, of course, some people have on our side of the argument have pointed out that in advanced countries and Britain in particular, carbon emissions per capita are already falling and have been falling for quite a while. The counter argument is that, well, isn't this just because we outsource carbon-intensive production to poorer countries? And there is a way you can control for that, and that is if you look at carbon emission per capita on the basis of consumption rather than production. So if you outsource the production of something to China, but then import the product, whether that's clothing or something else, you would still count the carbon emissions contained in that clothing. Because that's part of because it's consumed here in Britain, and you would attribute that to Britain, not mm-hmm. China. So that's an alternative way of looking at that, better way, and it shows, yes, it does make a difference. If we look at it in consumption terms rather than production terms, the fall isn't quite as steep, but it is still falling. It is still true, even on a consumption-adjusted basis. That emissions per capita have fallen by something like a third over the past 1.5 decades, and that we're definitely beyond the peak of carbon emissions per capita, and that is true across the developed world. We've reached the peak a couple of years ago. We're now beyond that, and carbon emissions are already falling. And so it clearly isn't true anymore that more growth means more carbon. We have already crossed that zenith, and therefore, what's the problem here?
I mean, you touched on this a bit before, Christian, but you know, Britain has a long history of environmental groups and protests. What, if anything, is different about today's environmentalism?
Yes, it's true that there's nothing fundamentally new about Extinction Rebellion. And there is even a direct predecessor movement about 15 years ago or so, in the mid-2000s, there was the Climate Camps movement, where it's not that well remembered because it didn't have the same media echo, but it was a similar concept. These were groups who were setting up camps, I mean, literal camps with tents, around some company that they wanted to disrupt. A power station or an airport, and it was in part a protest. They would do something to disrupt that company, and in part a conference of sorts where they would gather around their tents and talk about environmentalism. So sounds a bit like Extinction Rebellion. That, you could say, is the direct predecessor. And that's one of the things that I find so bizarre about Extinction Rebellion, is that they seem to believe that before they came along, nobody ever talked about climate change. Climate change has been a high-profile issue for over 20 years. And that's one of the reasons why I consider Extinction Rebellion a totally unnecessary movement. Nobody needs to raise awareness of climate change.
Yeah.
Everyone is aware of climate change. Yeah. It's been an absolute high-profile priority issue for well over 20 years. Everyone is aware of it, and politicians are doing a huge amount about it, and have been since at least the 90s. But on the question, what's different? I'd say what is different about the current lot is this fusion of environmentalism with the trendy post-Corbynite millennial socialism. The very early environmentalists, Emily is right that there's always been an anti-capitalist basis. It's always been, anti-capitalism has always been in the background, the main aim, and the environmentalist stuff is just something that is just a convenient vehicle for that. That's always been the case. So environmentalist groups have always been anti-capitalist, but the current ones are specifically in favor of a socialist alternative, whereas previous ones would have been just anti something, not so clear about what they want instead. And that means previous environmentalist groups were quite openly puritanical. They'd say this, we have to reduce our living standards, we have to lead minimalist lifestyles, what we talked about before. Whereas with the current lot, there is this message that climate change is, or environmental problems more generally, is something that's only caused by a small elite of capitalists. Mm-hmm. That's where this whole system change rhetoric comes from. It's perhaps best expressed by the Corbynite MP, Zara Sultana, who tweeted the other day, can't remember the exact words, but she said, just 100 companies in the world are responsible for 71% of CO2 emissions. This is a problem of capitalism, the system, is to blame. And that's the current message. This is repeated all over Twitter, and she got over 20,000 retweets, I think, as a super trendy opinion. But of course, it's absolute nonsense. It creates the impression that climate change has nothing to do with us, the average consumer. It's just a handful of billionaires who are doing this all. Yeah. But of course, these
companies... Why does she think these companies exist?
Yeah, well, it's not that they just dig fossil fuels out of the ground and burn them for fun and somehow get rich in that process. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the report where this comes from, this figure, the companies they list, what they do is they trace all carbon emissions back to the original primary energy source, so oil or coal. And then, of course, if you do it that way, if you allocate carbon emissions in that way, of course, you're going to come up with a small number of companies, because there aren't that many oil companies in the world. There's only a small number of countries that have oil reserves to begin with. And then within those countries, there's not many companies. It's often a state-owned monopoly. So the companies that are in that list are exactly the companies you would expect to be.
I didn't realize that they were actually the fossil fuel companies themselves.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I thought it's were the corporates who were.
No. It's Saudi Arabia state-owned oil company, the oil company of Iran, Gazprom obviously is in there, the Venezuelan state-owned oil company, Petróleos de Venezuela, they are of course in there. That Mexican oil company, which was in the news because of that gas leak in the ocean the other week. So it's companies of that sort, and a large Chinese coal company. They are the companies that are in there, the ones that you would expect to be in there. Of course, if you shut down those companies, then we would very much notice a difference.
Yeah.
And if you say it's just those 100 companies, it sounds like it's all something that other people do, got nothing to do with us. Mm.
Yeah, if anyone wants to be deeply depressed by the state of politics, check out Zara Sultana's Twitter feed, full of cliches, sound bites, and student union politics.
Just going back on what you said before, Christian, is like you were saying, there's no need to raise awareness now because everyone's concerned about the climate. We all do it every single day. But to be devil's advocate here, maybe their argument is we're not doing it quickly enough. You know, we're being too complacent, we're being too slow. And this leads on to my next question, so both feel free to jump in. You know, one of the demands by XR is for divestment or disinvestment from fossil fuel producers. So do you think these demands are reasonable and tolerable for the public at large? And can such an environmental strategy actually work?
No, it's a red herring. It's similar to what I've just described, the idea that this is just other people doing climate change is just something that a few billionaires do, and we can somehow get rid of 71% of carbon emissions without us noticing any difference. This is similar. There you're shifting all the focus on the producers. But of course, you can't make it harder to produce and sell something without also making it harder to buy that product and consume it. There is no way in which you can, for example, make it harder to brew beer without also making it harder to drink beer. If you shut down the breweries, there will be less beer available. And yeah, you can rhetorically say, oh no, I'm just against big brewing. I'm just against big beer. It's not the average beer drinker that I have a problem with. It's just those companies, but you can't separate those two. And this is one of those issues. Yes, of course, let's imagine Extinction Rebellion are successful with this divestment campaign. They managed to pressure several large investors, let's say, several pension funds, banks, to pull all their investment out of fossil fuel companies. What would that mean? Well, it would just mean it would raise the capital costs for fossil fuel companies. They would have to pay higher interest rates. They would have to secure other sources of capital, of finance. And that's just an indirect way of raising their production costs, which would then ultimately lead to higher energy prices. So it isn't different from what a green tax would also do. Mm. It would indirectly also make the products that they're making more expensive. It's a clumsy roundabout way of increasing their cost of doing business. And they would ultimately, of course, have to pass that on to the consumer. So it makes it sound as if you only hit those companies, unlike a green tax, which directly hits the consumer, but the effect would be exactly the same.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it'd be devastating for the poorest in the world who rely on fossil fuels. And, you know, it's all well and good to say we've got these new technologies and so on, but a lot of them remain in their infancy, and they won't be able to power the world for many, many years. And fundamentally, these people need to realise that the majority of people in this world rely on fossil fuels. Mm. They do a lot more good than harm in the round for most people in this world. And these kind of soundbite, let's disinvest or divest, whatever they say, from fossil fuels, will just hit the poorest the hardest, and it's totally unworkable. I mean, you see these protesters outside the Oxbridge colleges campaigning for divestment, and I mean, how do they think that their college is being heated? It's just the unfortunately the technologies aren't there yet to replace fossil fuels. And by completely removing fossil fuels, I mean, it's just very naive.
It's also very expensive, and I imagine a lot of normal working class people in the north, you know, the new blue wall, will you know, be completely apathetic to these aims. And that's perfect moving on to the next question, because we've already had a barrage of proposals to cut the UK CO2 emissions, including replacing all household gas boilers by 2023. Now, there's been a lot of problems with that, because everyone's going to have to get a grant and replace it with heat source pumps, which are inefficient, which also means that people are going to have to insulate their houses. So it's added costs, which people just can't afford. The UK's green agenda is estimated to cost $3 trillion, but Extinction Rebellion want further climate change policies. Do you think it's right for people in the UK to pay the price for reducing CO2 emissions when nations like China are still using and even building new coal-powered power stations? The UK is the second lowest CO2 emission, has the second lowest CO2 emissions per capita in the G7. So should we be making others do more, Emily?
Well, I think as people come to realise just how far-reaching these net zero targets, well, how much they will reach into their lives, their pockets, and change their way of life if the government does choose to stick to these targets, they'll start to think of it as an act of economic self-harm if countries like China, if countries like India are continuing to use fossil fuels and grow their use of fossil fuels, as we've seen with the number of coal plants that are being built in China every year. And it's often argued, of course, that we should be, you know, even though we're a small emitter on the grand scale, it's up to us to, well, teach the world and encourage the world to change their ways. But we've seen India walk out of environmental discussions. China pays lip service to climate change, but then their actions very much contradict what they say. So, I mean, it's very difficult. I don't think it will play well with the public. And although I said at the start that many people are on board with tackling climate change, when they see the reality of the prohibitions, the taxes, the potential for bans on certain types of travel and so on, I think that may change. And I think the government is very lofty in its aims, but how practical, well, we've seen that so many of their changes aren't practical. Mm. We've seen that they've had to shift back their ban on gas boilers. We've seen them, you know, I think they'll have to do the same with their ban on petrol and diesel, because they set these goals, and when it comes down to it, it's much harder to achieve than they say it will be.
Yeah, the argument that they usually make is that Britain's emissions may be low today, 1% of global emissions. That may be a low number today, but they'd say Britain has a historic responsibility because the Industrial Revolution started here, of course, so 200 years ago. Britain would have been accountable for close to 100% of the world's emissions. And therefore, in cumulative terms, it looks different. There's the historic legacy. But even in cumulative terms, and we have data on that, it doesn't look that fundamentally different anymore. It is still true at the moment. If you look at emissions, not just this year, but over the course of world history, then, of course, the British figure would be higher than 1%. Mm. But even in cumulative terms, it's changing rapidly. And the Western peak, the time when the Western world accounted for most of the cumulative emissions, I think that's already over. And the reason for that is that, yes, of course, Britain has a more than a 200-year history of industry, but the industry of the 19th century in the countries where it started was quite primitive and compared to today with a small population. So even in cumulative terms, that isn't a lot. That's quite different from countries, large countries, China and India, that are that industrialized later and that grew at much faster rates because they could import the Western technology. And their carbon footprint increased much faster than the British one did during the Industrial Revolution. So even purely in cumulative terms, that argument, well, it might still just about work today, but that is quickly disappearing. And on the argument that Britain should be a sort of moral leader, lead by example, impose costs on ourselves so that others follow, well, there the counter argument would be that if developing countries observe that Britain is ruining its economy with a green agenda, then their conclusion, of course, would be, oh, look, that's a bad idea. Let's not do that.
Yeah.
It could only have that role model effect if we manage to do it in a smart way. If we manage to reduce emissions and without becoming poorer in the process, then yes, then it could be that that other governments will observe this and think, oh, okay, it can be done in a low-cost way. That's maybe we should go for that. But if we crash our own economy in order to be a moral leader, then it's going to have the absolute opposite effect. Then the Chinese and the Indian governments are going to say, oh, look, the Brits ruined themselves. Well, let's not do what they did.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, that's all we've got time for. But thank you to Emily Carver, Head of Media, and Dr. Christian Niemitz, Head of Political Economy at the Institute of Economic Affairs.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the IA podcast on Podbean, Spotify, or Apple. We also upload our podcast on our YouTube channel, IEA London. If you want to help contribute to the IEA's digital output, please support us on Patreon, where you can benefit from exclusive membership perks whilst helping us continue to produce stimulating educational output. To become an online patron, click the link in the show notes.